Hare Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sah Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavaditamastamavidvishavahai Om Shanti 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 Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Physical is divine. Karma Mimamsa applies the theory of the all-pervading presence. Is that like that? Slow. By providing scientific practices. Oh, okay. Applies the theory of the all-pervading presence of divinity by providing specific practices designed to remind the student of this truth. For example, the use of common objects such as water, fruit, incense, grass, stones, and fire in rituals links the mundane with the divine. There is a prescribed way for gathering these items for the ritual and for handling and using them during the ceremony. For instance, before a blade of grass is uprooted, one needs to recite a specific mantra to revere and glorify the divinity within the grass, to ask permission to uproot the grass and use it in the ceremony. When the grass is uprooted, one recites another mantra, explaining the process in the following sense. I am uprooting my negatives symbolized by the grass. Even within negatives, there is divinity. I am uprooting it for the use in the ritual, in which the real nature of divinity is going to be unveiled. Thus, a pantheistic concept of God is encouraged in Karmakanda for those who are unable to conceive of the divine in any other way. The idea of seeing everything as divine is to check the mind from being overcome by hatred, jealousy, anger, greed, and all other negative attitudes. This practice helps one to arrive at the impersonal realization expressed in such Vedic statements as, the whole universe is Brahman, and thou art that. Okay, so 25, footnote. According to Vedanta, yes.
Pantheistic, what is that?
Pantheistic means many. Pantheistic, I think it means nature is God.
Okay.
I think. Polytheistic is many gods.
Okay.
Monotheistic is one God. Atheistic, there's no God. Right? Right. Yeah, so like that. According to Vedanta philosophy, one should see everything in connection to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srimad Bhagavatam 11.13.24, the Lord says, within this world, whatever is perceived by the mind, speech, eyes, or other senses is me alone, and nothing besides me. All of you, please understand this by a straightforward analysis of the facts. Right? So we see here is there's a difference here, what's being presented, what Krishna is presenting, of how everything is him. Mm-hmm. And in this Karmakanda, or this Karma Mimamsa practice, where you're seeing the divine in everything, right? Mm-hmm. Because what Krishna means is that he, the person, he has, through his potencies, has expanded. Right? Because though you're trying to see the Lord in everything, you're trying to eventually remember the person, Godhead. It's not just to know enough that the divine is in everything. But the point is who is that divine? Right? So that's why the one sounds kind of mystical in that, and the other one, Krishna's presenting it. All of you, please understand this by a straightforward analysis of the facts. It's just like no mystique. It's that if God is everything, everything has to be him. So that means you can see him in everything. Everything has a connection to him. Everything can be connected to him. Does that make sense? So like that, it's there. It's just which ones are more direct and which ones are indirect, which ones are more pleasing, which ones you have to really go around the block to find, you know, how to connect them. Mm. But they all connect. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Right.
Yes.
So the process connecting through the guru must be really good because it's personal and then it's like a reflection.
Yes. Yes. I mean, so that element of the, in other words, the Lord, the Vaishnavas, right, his energies, this is all what one wants to be able to see. But that has to be based on the instruction gained from the spiritual master. Right? Because otherwise, depending upon your line, is what is the perspective you're going to gain. So that's why you want to be careful to always stick to one's own line. So that's why it's not recommended to read many books. One is that you have to have great intelligence to be able to accommodate so many wide varieties of instructions and amalgamate them all into, you know, a homogeneous working formula like that. The other is that, and that's when you can see things consistently, that all the different instructions are all part of the same principles that you're working on. Now, what's more difficult is when someone who's not able to see like that then reads so many books, then for him there's contradiction. And so then not only does it create a problem if it doesn't harmonize, but it may even distract from or even break down his appreciation of like that. So that's why there's always the principle of going back to guru, having guru working from that principle. Is that important? And then from there one expands out. So that's also why we see in Kali Yuga, Lord Chaitanya gives this principle, the founder Acharya. Very important, because he sets the whole mood for the length of his mission. Right? Now they'll still, in the present day though, it's been, you know, I think 1200 years or something, then they are still interpreting, you know, the scriptures and its application to the present situation by the Sri Vaishnavas of what Ramanuja gave, or the last 700 years for what Madhva gave. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's been, for Nimbarka it's been 5,000 years, right? So they're still following that line. So that's why the founder Acharya is important. Founder Acharya isn't something to be tossed around. You know, it's not like, hey, why don't you do like this? No, it's my house, I do what I want. No, but Prabhupada said that. He's the founder Acharya. In my house, I'm the founder Acharya. You don't do that kind of stuff. It's not a light term that you just say. You know, it's not like you say, well, in my house, I'm God. You know, okay, you can say that, but the point is that, you know, it's not going to work. So the founder Acharya means he's the one who's established the mission and gives the particular hermeneutics, that remumps of how to interpret all the verses. So whatever we're reading, then we see it in line with the Gaudiya Vaishnava. Right?
So you mentioned Mahaprabhu established the principle of founder Acharya.
Yeah.
Was there a particular incident that happened?
There was five incidents. Means all the different acharyas from the four sampradayas and Shankar, when they came through Navadvipa. Uh-huh. So when they came through Navadvipa, they got darshan of Lord Chaitanya, uh-huh, and he told them their philosophy.
So before appearance, actually.
Yes. Oh. Yes. So it means, because the Navadvipa pastimes are always going on. It's just a matter of when they manifest, so they can be appreciated, seen, and then when they're not, uh-huh, like that. Is that okay? Yeah, so it's specifically because that's how the preaching works nicely. Because otherwise you have teacher to student, and so it works perfectly as far as the knowledge coming down, you know, unsullied. But the problem is to expand it dynamically. That's where then the founder Acharya works. Because the other one then in its idyllic form, then you have to go, you have to have, you know, Uttamadhikari, then go to Uttamadhikari like this and be handed down. Right? And then others can get benefit. But then in the when you're using the founder Acharya, even if the person preaching is not themselves an Uttamadhikari by realization, they're speaking the knowledge and direction and way of application of the Uttamadhikari. Mm-hmm. So that's why even new bhaktas can preach and actually be successful. Mm-hmm. You know, in convincing people, making devotees, doing wonderful things, because they're acting on the instruction of. Right? So then that's always alive. Because otherwise you would think that it goes down to my spiritual master, so now previous one doesn't matter. But the founder means it's always going to be your teacher and the founder acharya. So even after 100 generations, the diksha generations, it's still going to be the present guru and Prabhupada. That's why it's such a special system. So when people say they're the founder of this, it's not a managerial term or political term to be used like that. In this context, the founder acharya means the Adi Guru, the one who sets the standards by which. So Prabhupada said his books would be valid for 10,000 years. So that's the length of his mission. Right? So then they'll be there. And so it'll work. So if one sticks to that, then it doesn't matter. It will always work. You know, of course, you know, after a while, then, you know, depending upon if the quality of the age improves, then of course they'll be able to maintain understanding the Prabhupada's English, but probably near the end you'll have to have a translation because it'll be like Latin or something. You know? When you have a 25-word vocabulary, you know. Then yeah, like that. Yeah, so that'll be interesting. Yeah.
So book editing will go on, and then gradually.
Yeah.
And the reason it's Prabhupada is because he adjusted it so it could be understood by the whole world.
It's not a matter of adjusting, it's just a matter of presentation.
Presented.
That's all. Because the point is, as we go through to these technical points that we're getting into, none of these are things that Prabhupada hasn't given. But it's just because he uses a simple language, then we may not catch the technicalness of it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? When things are technical, then we think, oh, okay, this is technical. Right? But Prabhupada is speaking very technical things, but in a simple way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we noticed, we went through the first year Gita, so that's okay, straightforward. But when we went to the second year, we see Prabhupada's mentioning things that we generally never even notice. We don't even hear devotees talk about them. But it's only because understanding more of the technical process, then you can see what Prabhupada's talking about. You know? So it's interesting, it's like sometimes you see where they have the purport of the of like Baladeva Vishwanath and then Prabhupada's purport on the same verse. And sometimes it's thought, oh, Prabhupada doesn't mention so many things, but he does if you look at it. But he just does it in a very simple way. Because the point is if you understand more, you'll catch that. But if you don't understand more, you'll catch something. Because otherwise, in the technical presentation, if you don't catch the whole thing, you don't really get anything. The Prabhupada's purport is such that even you just catch a few of the words, you get some benefit. And then as you go, you get more of the words, more, like that. You know, because now we know, okay, prema bhakti, that's, you know, we get that at the end. But someone who has prema bhakti, it has a whole deeper meaning.
Does that
make sense? But, you know, so it's just naturally spans. So that's the expertise. So it's not just some ordinary stuff. Does that make sense? You know, and technically then it's very exact. He uses the words very exactly. Even though he's using simple English, he's using them in a very exact way. Like that. So, okay. Then this is confirmed in the Chaturshloki Bhagavatam. Brahma, it is I, the personality of Godhead, who was existing before the creation, when there was nothing but myself. Nor was there the material nature, the cause of this creation. That which you see now is also I, the personality of Godhead. And after annihilation, what remains will also be I, the personality of Godhead. O Brahma, whatever appears to be of any value, if it is without relation to me, has no reality. Know it as my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. O Brahma, please know that the universal elements enter into the cosmos and at the same time do not enter into the cosmos. Similarly, I myself also exist within everything created, and at the same time, I am outside of everything. A person who is searching after the supreme absolute truth, the personality of Godhead, must certainly search for it up to this, in all circumstances, in all space and time, and both directly and indirectly. So he's pointing out that it's him that's there. And so even if we say it's his Brahman, it's still him, the personality of Godhead. But he's simultaneously there personally, and not their person. Right? That's the thing. Because if you understand, it's him means it's his energy, so it's the person's energy, so therefore it's the person. But now to appreciate the person, you appreciate the person, then the person is found there. And if you don't, then just the energies are found. So that's why these mimamsakas and others, they are appreciating the energy or the divinity, but they don't understand the person that the divinity is from. So therefore, then they just see the divinity in everything. So here, they're using the grass. So the grass means whatever is the Lord of the grass and how they're supposed to relate to the grass and what they're used for. At the same time, it's like the principle of uprooting bad things from the heart. So then it also represents that. So it has the positive and the negative. Right? Because you have yama and niyama. So what to do and what not to do. So both are valuable. Why always remember Krishna as the positive, but don't forget is the negative. So you're doing those things to remove the negative. And you're also, it's going to be used in sacrifice too for the positive. But they're not catching how it connects back to the Lord. So they're only seeing that Brahman level, but even then only for the purpose of karma. So it's not even the Brahman level for realization of Brahman. Sources of valid knowledge. Mimamsa, like many other philosophical systems, places great importance on the study of nature and the sources of valid knowledge, pramanas. According to Mimamsa, there are six different sources of valid knowledge: perception, inference, comparison, testimony, postulation, and non-perception. Non-perception is recognized as a source only by the school of Kumari Labhata, and not by that of Prabhakar. Right. Karmamimamsa emphasizes testimony as a source of knowledge because it behaves exclusively on the authority of the Veda. 26. Karmamimamsa attempts to establish the absolute authority of the Veda without a reference to God. Right. So the one is, you could say, is that, well, but Nyaya and those, Nyaya Vaisheshika, they accept that God's there. And so how, you know, but this is supposed to be a higher philosophy, but it's not. It's trying to establish without God, right? Nyaya, they believe in God, but they know people don't. But they're showing through logic, even if you don't believe, you can see there's still God, right? So one might ask, how is that? How is this superior? Mm-hmm. And then what we were discussing before, the Madhvas point out that the first four of the schools, they're only dealing with certain portions of the Veda. So it's easy, right? So you can accept God because you don't have to deal with all the verses and this and that. So you just pick what you want and it's all right. But Karma Mimamsa is accepting the Veda as it is, the whole thing. Of course, they're going to interpret it in a limited way. So that becomes the problem. They're applying their limited philosophy to all the verses. Right? And so that's the thing. So they try to do it without the Lord. The others are not worried about the Lord anyway, but they're dealing with a limited amount of verses. So then it doesn't matter. They're acknowledging God's presence. But, you know, there's no real interest in God. Right? So here is, they're kind of trying to do it without acknowledging. And there's not any interest either. Right.
Karmakanda and Karmamimamsa are the same thing?
No, Karmakanda is that portion of the Veda which tells if you want a fruitive result, this is the method how you get it. But it's not a philosophy, it's just a process. But if you want good health, you worship the sun, this is the particular rituals. Yes. But Karmamimamsa means it's their philosophy that I can be happy eternally just by doing good work. Yes. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like you go down to the supermarket, you pick up the things you want, you go to the counter, you pay, you have them. Mm-hmm. It's not a philosophy, it's just how it works. You want that, you go there. You don't want it, you don't go there. Right? But if you make it a philosophy that you can be eternally happy shopping in the supermarket... Right? Now that's a philosophy. Now they'll use the ritual of the same, going to the thing, picking like that, but, you know, that's all. You know, instead, and then when you finish, then you just go back and go back inside, get more stuff. You just keep the process going. Right?
Karmakanda, is that niti? Niti?
Karmakanda? Means you could say niti is kind of like a branch of it, but niti is more being practical in the moment, right? Dharma, you're being practical, but considering the whole, everything that there is to consider, means within the material purview of action. So the individuals involved, the natures of those, the natures of their relationship, the natures of what they can do, everything like that. So based on that, then you're making. So then there's long term, because something like this, the nature of this thing is it may give me immediate results, but in the long term it won't. So therefore, it may not be used now. It doesn't matter, you know, the future, because it's something immediate. You know, I cut the knife, it becomes dirty. You know, so it doesn't matter. So then I wash it. But if there may be other considerations where you don't want that to happen. You know what I'm saying? Like, I go into the kitchen's supposed to be clean, guests are coming over and all that, and I'm hungry, so if I do something, cut something and make a mess, but there's an alternative, I could use something else and then leave it. You know what I'm saying? So you're looking at the bigger picture. Well, the other one is you look, oh, I want this, and it doesn't matter. So niti is just looking at the practical, how it works. So we use niti, but we always use it in connection with dharma. But the problem is those who follow niti only look at that. You know, what immediately will get you the results. You know, like for Duryodhan, by sending them away to Varnavata, it immediately got rid of them. But what he didn't see is that the other support and other things like that, it ended up, they came back stronger than they were. Before, they're just a member of the family. So they don't have any of their own alliances, their own power base, their own wealth, their own anything. But now, after having come back from Varnavata, now they're married, so they're in a good status. They have Drupad as their ally and father-in-law. He's a big king. He's not a small kingdom. He's a big kingdom. Virat, that's a small kingdom. But Drupad, that was big. Right? And not only that, he has a son that's going to kill the guru of Duryodhana's line. Right? So he's powerful. So now they come back way more situated than before, to the point where it's better to give them half the kingdom than lose the whole kingdom. You know what I'm saying? So that's the problem with niti. While Yudhishthira worked on dharma, so it appears to be working slower, because he's following the rules, but he ends up in the forest, he ends up this, he ends up that. But at the end, then he's unrivaled king. Right? Because Duryodhana and everybody's gone. What Duryodhana was trying to do with five people, he couldn't work by niti. But by dharma, you got rid of 100 people. Right? So it just takes longer. Yes.
Can dharma and niti be used simultaneously?
Yes, as long as dharma is the prominent.
So niti should support dharma?
Yeah. Niti just means being practical. That's all. You know, the practical, in the moment, what you can do. You know, it's just like, okay, I want to do this, so then, you know, I can move these over there. And it gets the work done. It clears this up because I want to do something. But then, 2 minutes later, I want to give class, so now it's over there, not here. So I'm not considering the concept of the class. So the point is niti just deals with what's practical right now. But the point is dharma shows what's the bigger picture of how what you're doing now fits into the whole scheme. What is the whole scheme and how that fits? Well, niti doesn't look at the whole scheme. It just doesn't. You know what I'm saying? So niti is important. We use it every day. But it can't be exclusively what we use. Otherwise, then we're working in a very small circle, and so our results are also going to be very short-lived. Is that something?
Yeah. Can we say, Maharaj, that in Kali Yuga, the Karma Mimamsa will be most popular thing for the Kali Yuga people?
Means for those who are religious and like a regulated lifestyle, then it will be. If people just like to do a little bit of something or ritualize, then means it'll also be there, but these other systems might be more. In other words, if someone's looking at lifestyle, the Karma Mimamsa, if someone's simply looking at the intellectual, then the others would be much more interesting. Because this, if you look at it, then the conclusion is you have to adjust your life.
Yeah.
Like that. But if you don't want to adjust your life, you just want to sit in your armchair down at the university, then you just want to get into the intellectualization of the other systems often. You know what I'm saying? Because otherwise, this, because karma, this is the only one that deals with karma, so that'll be your lifestyle. The other ones, it'll deal with gyan. So then basically you can do whatever you want. You shouldn't. There is a natural lifestyle of renunciation that goes with it. But nowadays, people are impersonalist without renunciation. You know, the yogis without renunciation. You know, saying yoga, you have to go to the forest and give up everything. But they want to do yoga and enjoy life. You know, so that's the thing. And the impersonal is simply just to enjoy life. So it means you could say maybe others, some take that, but they don't like the rituals being controlled. So unless they're from that kind of background, then it may mean something. But generally then they already are rooted in their particular brand of karmic milamsa, and they think any other brand is bogus. You know.
We noticed then when we studied yoga, then among nowadays yogis, celibacy and brahmacharya is not what they ever preach.
Oh, not at all.
Live it like.
No, you just don't get near that.
Then it doesn't exist. Because yeah. Otherwise everybody, the studio is empty.
Yeah. But when they have some serious students that ask about it, they'll say yes. And then they might recommend a few things, but they don't want it to become too, you know, like that. It's one of those things, if you like to do it, then it's a good thing. It's nice. It's beneficial.
Yeah.
If not, then... Yeah. Yeah, they just avoid these things.
Generally, they say brahmacharya means moderation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can also say it just means a student of Brahman, you know, which are all true, but the point is the ones won't really catch that without the celibacy. That's the difficulty. Okay, we're going on the footnote 26. Karma Mimamsa attempts to establish the absolute authority of the Veda without a reference to God. Quote, okay. In defending the validity of this way of knowing, testimony, the Mimamsaka's main interest was to defend the authoritativeness of the Veda. The Veda in the beginning was not written on paper or stone, but was orally handed down from generation to generation. The followers of Nyaya accept that God was the composer of the Vedas, and that they were, therefore, absolutely true. But the Mimamsakas do not accept the reality of God at all, and had, therefore, to defend the validity of the Vedic utterances in a different way. They said that the Vedas are not composed by anyone. They are existing in the world without beginning, and would exist without end. Right? So, in one sense, they're true, but what they don't understand is it is still coming from the Lord, but they're not composed because they've always been there. They've eternally been there. You know, just like the jiva is not created by the Lord, but expands from the Lord. The world also has no beginning and will have no end. Oh well, have a rude awakening at one point, right? The Vedic sound is eternal. In fact, according to the school, all words are eternal. Right? Always in any significant language, the word must have some meaning. The Mimamsakas do not accept that the Vedic language was conventional, but that it was the natural language with natural meanings, and that therefore must have existed forever and have been transmitted from time without beginning. Right? So the thing is they're having elements that have truth to them or facts to them, but the problem is they're not able to connect it to the Lord. So the words have meaning, but it's not that the form of the word has the meaning. It's that form carries the potency. That's it. So it's the Lord's potency within the matter that makes it work. But the point is that word is based on the actual word. It means like you have something here. It means what it is. But the point is in the spiritual world, there is that thing. It's always there. While here, it's temporary. So here, that word will carry that potency. Right, but they're trying to say is no, the word itself is eternal. right? The transcendental word, you know, how you say. Yeah. Just trying to think of that one thing or something. What is it? It's something about it and the word or something. Right? No? First chapter, you know, it's like. It was all about the word.
Yeah, in the beginning, there was.
The word.
No. In the beginning was the sound, and I was the sound.
In the beginning, there was sound, and I was sound.
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. So you're talking like that, but then the point is then it comes into what's here. Like that. So there's all these elements that have some truth, but then they misapply it. You know, that's the thing. Because the point is the Vedas were always there and this and that, but they still it came from the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But they're not able to understand these things. If it was eternal, then it doesn't need the Lord. But the point is no, the Lord's the one who's eternal. These are all aspects of Him. You know, His eternalness. Like that.
Is it also that since they can't understand spiritual, they can't understand time, actually? It has to come from some time. It can't be beyond time, or
yeah, probably means you have that, because then if it came from the Lord, means then there had to be a creative point rather than just a manifestation of it. But it's non-different from Him, so that's the, because He acts according to the Veda, and so that means the Veda is how He acts. Yeah. You know, like that. The Vedic conception of God had no active place in the Mimamsa scheme of life, as it had in the Vedanta one, and it is natural that it should gradually fade away. In its great anxiety to maintain the supremacy of the Vedas, the Mimamsa relegates God to an ambiguous position. It is here that the Vedanta comes to differ from it, utilizing its faith in the Vedas to develop the still greater faith in God, as we will see in the next chapter. So it's just because they're only interested in karma, you don't want there to be anything else. Because if there's God, then, because their whole point is obligation. What are your duties? So the point is, if there's a God, then there must be a duty or obligation. So they're not interested in that, because then that'll take it away from enjoying here. Because their idea is here, it goes on, here is nice, here is wonderful. Right? The Karma and Mimamsa theories of perception and inference are very similar to those of the Nyaya system, but the Karma and Mimamsa theory of comparison is quite different from that of Nyaya, although both ultimately base their theories on the similarity of two things, of which one is already known. Right. Postulation, artapati, is the necessary supposition of an unperceived fact to explain some apparently conflicting phenomena. For example, a person who does not eat during the day but constantly grows fat can be suspected of eating at night. Yeah. One cannot solve the contradiction between fasting and growing fat unless he assumes that the person eats at night. Right? So that will be postulation. Knowledge of the person eating at night cannot come under the category perception or inference, nor can it be reduced to testimony or comparison. Non-perception, anupalabdhi, is the source of one's immediate cognition of non-existent things. One can know the non-existence of a thing by the absence of its cognition. That is, if it is not present in the senses, it cannot be understood by any other source of valid knowledge. For instance, one can feel the absence of a jar that does not exist because it is not perceived by the senses. But one cannot say that the non-existence of the jar is inferred by its non-perception. Because an inference based on the universal's relationship between middle and major terms. Okay. Because an inference is based on universal's relationship between middle and major terms. So that there isn't something there. There's nothing there. There's a counter, but it's not that, you know, counters are always related to jars, so therefore there's no jar, therefore there, you know. Here it's saying the senses can't perceive a jar, therefore there's no jar. Mm. Yes?
But with the example
about getting fat, that can be perceived by the senses. So it's similar to the see smoke, to the example, the inference of you see smoke on the hill, where there's smoke, there's fire, therefore there's fire on the hill.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, this is a conflicting phenomena. You know, like fire on mountains is not conflicting. Mm. The problem here is that the person's not eating and getting fat. So how is that happening? Because you get fat by eating, right? You know, unless they just somehow or another breathe a lot of air or something. You know, sometimes it becomes really, really big, you know, like that. You know, he's controlling his breath. Huh?
It's called Ramadan.
Ramadan.
You know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, true. That's where this came from. You know, like that, yeah. Because you never eat during the day. You only eat at night. You get up at 3 in the morning and eat and like that. That's pretty wild to eat at 3 in the morning. That's really weird. But seems to work. So it's not so much that they're fasting, it's just inconvenient.
Yeah.
Right? Because they fast all night and no one minds.
Yeah.
They hear you fasting during the day and then eating all night, you know, like that. So.
Whereas, I think Prabhupada used that inference at the time whenever he was with some of his disciples and he saw a fat taxi driver, and he was telling some story. If you see a person, you can ask them where do they get their vegetables or their grains from, because he obviously has good supply. They said, well, his disciples, and he said, go and ask him where he gets his rice. And the disciple went over and he's asking, and the guy's like confused. He's like, do you know why are you asking me this? That's more like inference, right, than postulation.
Yeah, because there it's that he's eating nicely. We're not. See, the one is, you know, he doesn't eat in the day, so no one's ever seen him eat, but he's getting fat. So that means he has to be eating at a time when not. So there's a contradiction.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, we would take this and put it back into inference, like what Mataji was saying, because they make it all as different things of that, because we'll take it down to perception, inference, and shabda. Right, so even comparison we'll put back down into inference or perception. So, like this, they accept 6, some accept 8?
Some 10.
All it is subdivisions of the same thing. Because you see, is when Nyaya is describing one of these things, it has so many subdivisions. So some will consider some subdivisions as more major, so they'll just elevate them to its own perception. But that's what Nyaya does, is goes through and shows how it can't be. Right, but it'll end up with 4. And so Jiva Goswami will go through and show how, well, it's actually only 3. So the same. Yeah, yeah. The point is if he's a taxi driver and he's healthy, that means he must have some really good supply. So where is he getting it from? Where is it? You know, he's getting some good quality stuff. you know. Yeah, but the taxi driver wouldn't be thinking like that. He thinks, I'm a taxi driver. Why would he ask me about that? No, the point is you're a fat taxi driver. That's why we're asking. If you're a skinny taxi driver, we wouldn't ask you. So it's nothing to do with your taxi. Right? Okay, so they're putting it here is that it's not inference because it's not perceived by the senses. So it's not perceived by the senses, then you're going by the negative. So that's an element that's used, but as we remember within Nyaya, it was simply within the inference, it was an element within that. The negative was also there. Generally, it would always work in the positive, but you could also apply the same things to the negative. But they remove that from there because it's different, because you work in the negative instead of positive, and then make it into its own system. Therefore, direct knowledge of the non-existence of a jar can be explained only if non-perception is recognized as a separate and independent source of knowledge. Right? Like that. So they're taking it as an independent source, while we would take it as not an independent source. You know, it would be just a subsection of an already existing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Prayojana. According to Mimamsa, man has to be always active. Without action, he cannot have any condition of life, good or bad. Everyone desires happiness here and hereafter. Therefore, one should know that activities to what activities to perform and what to avoid. Right? It means if you want to be happy now and happy later, you have to know what to do that you become happy now and that they won't have a problem on being happy later. Yes.
How do they account for the inherent unhappiness of the material world? If they're doing everything right, but still they're experiencing distress.
Means there must be something in the past that you didn't do right, so you'll correct it by doing it right now. Like that. You know, so that means, in other words, to follow this, you have to have some faith, some good qualities, some renunciation, knowledge, all these different things. The problem is they're misapplying all this nice knowledge and endeavor to simply try to enjoy here. Well, if they took that same knowledge and regulation and endeavor and applied it into Krishna consciousness, then they would progress actually quite nicely, right? Because they're very regulated, they're very dutiful, right? They see the Supreme Consciousness in relationship to everything. So they're already, in one sense, quite well situated. They're very, in other words, you can say they're very close to God, but they have their back to God, so they're going away.
And they put off immediate sense gratification.
Yes, for later. Yeah. In other words, unless it's appropriate that the sense gratification is happening now, then it's always a matter of ritual and yajna and sacrifice. Does that make sense? So they're very pious, but the problem is it's misdirected piety. You know, it's kind of like that African saying, working so hard to climb up the mountain, but only upon reaching the top to fall down the other side. You know, so they've done so much hard work, but you know it gets kind of lost in the translation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
This corresponds with what Krishna is saying to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, that even you can maintain your body without activity.
Without work, yes, you can. It means you have to do something. Even the lazy guy does have to get up, go to the fridge to get his beer. Right? You know? Or he had to at least...
Next to the sofa.
Yeah, well, that's there, but then that means he would have had to have filled it or made the endeavor to get someone to fill it. Right, so some endeavor had to be there.
He had to buy a fridge.
Yeah, he had to buy the fridge, or he had to pick it up on the sidewalk. Something, he had to do something. So without work, you can't maintain yourself. That's all. There's not possible, right? And then after, how do you say, taking full advantage of the fridge, then he's got to go to the bathroom. You know, so then it all works out. And we don't really want to hear of an alternative for that, so we'll leave it here. But that you'd have to go to Germany for, that one. Like that. Okay. Okay. So you have to know what to do, what not to do. So you have to have knowledge, because if you may be active, but if you're doing bad work, then you'll get bad results. So you have to know what work gets what results. Right? So that means knowledge. Right? And then that means restraint, because there may be an activity that's bad you'd want to do, but it'll give you a bad result. And there's an activity that's good you don't want to do, but you'll get a good result. Therefore, with that proper knowledge and all that, right, you know, so it takes some training, some good qualities like that. A conscious, active, happy life, enjoying all the values which the universe can offer, is the ideal for the Mimamsakas. Right, that's one of your sentences. Huh? Yeah, no, I'm saying that's one of the sentences, you know, like that. There's four or five sentences in this whole thing you could pull out, and you could start a whole movement with those, you know. You know, football stadium, you know, seminars, yeah, like that kind of thing. They had contempt for the life of a lifelong celibacy. They would not allow any of the ceremonies to be performed in the presence of a monk, and they ridiculed lifelong celibacy as a cloak for hiding impotence, right? Their point is you can't enjoy, therefore you're doing this, or you don't have the skill or the confidence to do, therefore you're not doing. They'll always do that. So, but according to the Vedas, that when they get to older, then they would renounce, they would do these things, right? Because you can't enjoy anymore, so therefore your endeavors will get more fruit from renunciation. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
They don't follow this practice?
No, they follow.
They do it, no.
Yeah, but they don't believe in a lifelong celibacy. It means the brahmachari must get married. Right? You must be a brahmachari, but then you must get married. And then perform all these rituals. Then later in life, at the end of life, then you renounce. But someone who would renounce early in life, they wouldn't appreciate. So someone like Shankaracharya and that, they didn't like him at all. They just consider, he's, running away from, the duties of life and reality and all this kind of thing. Yes.
It sounds very much like Daksha, because he didn't like the brahmachari thing.
Yeah. No, he had a problem. Like that. Because he's a karmakandi. Like that. So then they just think that duty means you have to do it like this. Not that the duty is for a higher purpose. See, it's basically what's happening is that someone who from a bona fide position sticks to brahmacharya throughout life, all it is this, the purpose is to detach yourself from the material world. So if they've already done that, they've already accomplished that. So there's no need to do that work. Right? So all it is just you're going to the position of already having obtained the purpose of doing it, right? Because if I have a machine to make juice, but I already have some, but why do I need the machine? You know what I'm saying? So the point is he has realization of not getting involved in the material entanglement. So therefore, there's no need to, because the idea of getting involved in the entanglement is to connect all of that to the Lord so that you start to see that it doesn't have any validity other than its connection to the Lord. So therefore, why work so hard to connect a huge volume of indirect things when you could spend that time to be engaging more of the direct? That's all. So if one's comfortable, one does that. So the problem is here is that, and anyway, how many people are lifelong celibates anyway? Right? There's only a few, but even those they complain about. Right, so they'll consider if there's a monk around, then you can't do any ceremonies or anything like that. They're just like, if there's a widow, you don't do like this. So they just consider the one inauspicious, and the other's inauspicious also, but they're an idiot, right? It's not that the widow can do much about it, but the celibate, he could do something about it. So he's a real, yeah, like that. There was a tendency among some mimamsakas to place humans even higher than the demigods, because it was thought that man are free to choose their destiny, right? Well, demigods just have to live with what they have, basically, it's like saying the man who's working hard at work is better than the guy who's on vacation, right? Because the guy on vacation, he has to just work with what he has. He doesn't have the free will to create more, while the man at work, he can create more. He has the freedom, that's kind of how they're looking at it. In contrast, the demigods cannot perform sacrifices for building up the future because they do not have a physical body. Thus, they are entitled only to enjoy the results of the past good deeds. Right? So it's just their ego just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so then, you get rid of God, you put yourself better than demigods and all this and that. And so, yes.
Isn't their result going to achieve heavenly life? Isn't that their goal?
That's there, but at the same time, it's not that they don't try to accomplish that here,
right?
Point is that'll get you there. But the point is that you'll enjoy that. But it is kind of like, you're responsible by being here. There, you're just enjoying the results of your work. Like I do my work, I enjoy the results. So you go there and enjoy the results. But it's actually the person performing the work is the better man. So I'm saying the muda is the better person. Like that. So that's. It means you do have elements where that's important, but it has to be that balance. So what they do is they twist things due to their false ego. So you see, it's like this as we go into it. That's the one thing that stands out is if you just take superficially, then it's okay. They have this. But as you go into it, then you see more and more the false ego, that I'm the controller, and joy has to be bigger and bigger to be able to accommodate and function within that. That's the difficulty. So that's why these things, if you go into these, then devotional service goes away. You can't be focused on this, you know, like that. It's something, if it's a value, you work. But still, there's a limit. You know, like one devotee, forget, whereas he was the president, they were having a big, huge Janmashtami program. So he'd just get up in the morning, eat something, go out all day, you know, collecting and that, come back late at night, eat something, go to sleep, get up in the morning. And so, you know, a lot was being accomplished and being done. But then Prabhupada happened to be visiting the temple at the time. And he called him and he says, you know, are you chanting? You know, and he said, no, I'm busy doing all this service. And Prabhupada said, no, your chanting is first. Like that. That should be accomplished. Because otherwise, all this is just to get people to chant. So then if you've accomplished this by not chanting, how is that an improvement? You know. So, you know, so there's a limit. There has to be that balance, right? Things are gained by work, but if there isn't also that proper utilization of what you've gained from work, you know, then also it's not balanced, like we were saying before. And the Niti mentions, so you have money but aren't using the money, then it's as good as having no money, right? You have millions of dollars, but you don't use it and you live like a poor person, you're as good as any other poor person. You can think, no, I'm better because I have millions in the bank, but you're living like a poor person. What's the difference, practically? Like that. Is that something? Oh, okay. The highest goal in the early karma mimamsa doctrine appears to have been the attainment of heaven, or a state in which there's unalloyed bliss. 27. Right, so that's their idea of unalloyed bliss. But, you know, then there's always the problem that it's not unalloyed because someone always has more unalloyed than you have.
You know. Do they deal with this like politics? Or, I mean, because when you're trying to enjoy the material, there's never enough.
There's not enough there either, but you just don't talk about it. Because here there's the idea, if I had more money, I'd be happy. Yeah. But the point is there's millions of people who are millionaires, yeah, and they're not happy because they want to, you hear about those people who have, you know, worth 4 or 5 million, okay? And you think, wow, that's great. But they're always thinking, you know, wish they had 15, 20 million. The guys with 20 million want to have 100 million. The guys with 100 million want to have a few hundred million. The guys with a few hundred million, they want a billion. And the guys with a billion want more billions. You know, so it never works. So you get to the heavenly planets. The point is you've done pious work to get you there. So that means according to your piety, you'll have particular physical beauty, particular wealth, particular facility. In other words, the house you live in, how what you look like, what kind of vehicle you drive, you know, what neighborhood you're in, like that. What are your associates? But there's always someone who's more pious. So he has a bigger chariot, and he has a bigger palace, and he's got more associates, and he looks better, right? It means for here is between, how you say, it's just like, let's say you have supermodels, okay? So for the ordinary person, they all look beautiful, but amongst the supermodels, they're each thinking this one looks better than that one, right? So that's what's going on there. It's just that you're doing it within a very pious environment. So it's only when you get there, then you figure out that it's the same thing. Just, you know, it's fancier. That's all. So that's the thing. It you're never satisfied, right? Because here it's like you have to work really hard to get a little bit of gold. Up there, there's a river. There's this huge mango tree. It's got these huge mangoes that have no skin and no seed. When they fall off the tree, they hit the bank, and it turns into juice. And so that river, the bank, is solid gold. So the demigods, when they need gold, they just come down and collect how much they want and take it back and do what they want with it. You know what I'm saying?
Sounds good.
Yeah, but at the same time, as somebody collected more.
Yeah.
You know.
So they're out there all day. Madmen.
Yeah, whatever it is, it's just... You know, it's never, never.
Whereas I heard in the heavenly planets, whenever the garland fades, then there's, like, I heard this in one lecture from the ISKCON guru, and they said the floor opens up, and you go through the hole in the floor, and then, but you can see through, the floor is see-through, and you can see, then your, like, life partner or whatever you were with there, she immediately goes with somebody else, and you're there, and then you see the flesh-eating demons, they tear your body apart, and then that's how the soul then comes down to the...
Well, you didn't catch the point. Point is, just, they're eating you alive, so therefore it's painful, so you cry, so the soul leaves with a tear.
Yeah.
And that tear falls as rain, and then that becomes the grain.
But they
they don't talk about that.
They don't mention
that at all. Just, they stay away from that stuff. This stuff is mentioned, you know, in other areas like that. But it's just Karmakanda doesn't talk about this stuff. Why would you talk about this stuff?
I just wanted to get the balance, because it's like, that sounds like...
Yeah. Well, it's not exactly, I don't think it's exactly like there's this hole, and then everyone looks... you know, it's just, you just go through the floor.
Yeah.
You know, it's you know, it's, you know what I'm saying, like that.
But it's all of a sudden?
Yeah. Just the time's up, so, you know, so the person's talking to... Okay. Talk to this guy.
And they don't realize that's going to be me one day.
No.
They just talk with someone
like that. Well, it's, there's all kinds of problems like that. It's just like, also, you go your whole life, as long as you're going to be there, you don't... The girls don't get pregnant, but if they get pregnant, that means then you only have that much time to live. When the child's born, then just after that, then it means when they're born, they immediately grow up to 16 years old and then walk off, you know, and then after that, then, you know, you're finished.
I never understood that, because isn't, like, the rest of life when they're kids and everything so nice?
Yeah, that's for here. But you want to enjoy.
Right.
In other words, you don't look at it this way. You don't have to hire babysitters. None of those things. It's all just, you know. The point is, they grow up like that because that's not where that rasa is tasted. It's tasted here. That's why it's not as complete. That's why the human pastimes are the best, because they have all the rasas in their completeness. Well, the other is just they have, you know, it's just like Aditi feels all those adults now. They're all her children. You know, so there's still that feeling, but it doesn't have that. That's why it said it's special, the childhood pastimes and these kind of things like that. So that's why the human is actually the better. It's balanced. Because the other one is just geared for a sense gratification. That's all.
All Shastra speak of itself as supreme. All Shastra, like Karmakanda, speak of itself as supreme. Or?
It'll talk about the specialness of these qualities and all these, because it means, like, you know, that working and getting the results of action and all that's the you know, the best of duties and all these kind of things. Mm. But the point is you're supposed to do that and offer the results to Krishna. So that part they may not talk about, you know, prominently. They'll mention it, but not prominently. So they just make whatever aspect would inspire that person.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm. You know, it's just like, let's say the kid is not, they're busy watching TV or something, it's time for dinner. Mm. So then they don't want to come, right? So you have to inspire them, oh, we made this and that and so many things. And once they get there, they eat, and then afterwards, then there's the dishes. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, but if you tell them, hey, you know, you can spend, you know, 10 minutes eating and then 20 minutes washing the dishes, so, hey, stop watching your program, they're not going to come. Right? So you only talk about the part that they like. So that's what the Shastra in that particular area talks about, those particular things. So it's correct, but at the same time, within perfect, there's a hierarchy. So each aspect is perfect, but there's a hierarchy. You know, so transcendence is the highest, and then that devotion to the Lord is the best of that. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like that. Yes.
It's all like a promotion thing, so don't we have the same in bhakti?
That's what is it, that sixth or seventh offense is. Is to think that the bhakti, when it's talking about it, the terms is just doing the same things that the Vedas are doing. The whole idea is that bhakti is what's normal for the living entity to do. And so the glories of bhakti there, those are just straightforward what they actually are. The other ones aren't normal, so you actually have to really play it up to. In other words, the exaggeration is you're only talking about it in that exclusive way. So it sounds better than it actually is. You don't mention the rest of the context. But with bhakti, there is no rest of the context. Mm-hmm. You know, you chant, you'd be happy. It's not that, you know, car's there, you know, it's got, you know, you know, you can get there quickly, right? Because it's a powerful car, and safely. You know, so it takes care. The husband's happy, the wife's happy. But they don't talk about, you know, the payments, the mortgages, you know, that even if you bought it on installment, that if you crash the car and it's total and you can't use it, still you're make payments for the next 10 years. They don't talk about all that kind of stuff. You know, does that make sense? So they don't mention those things, so they exclusively talk about that. But with bhakti, there are no side things. There's nothing hidden. There's no fine print. It's just as it is, because that's the natural thing of the living entity. Material is not natural. That's why you have to play it up a bit. Right? But they don't lie. They just don't talk about all the aspects of truth. But with bhakti, it's just straightforward. That's why Krishna says, as he said, just by fact, you just look at it. What's that one? Krishna's saying. All of you, please understand this by a straightforward analysis of the facts. Right? So his point is this, it's just straightforward. This is the facts. You can see it. So it's not an exaggeration. So when they're saying millions of times, you know, greater, you know, it doesn't even compare to a drop, it means that. It's actually what it is, just that we're not used to that. Because anything we say here, we say it's like that. Oh, this is going to be great, and this and that. It's not going to be great. It's going to be okay. You know, or maybe it's a little nice, you know. You know what I'm saying? That's just the way you talk. But here, when they say it's great, it's greater than great, it is. It's just, there's nothing to compare it here to. So. Does that make sense? Yeah. You know, just like for the Brahma bodies, they don't talk about when you get to the Brahman platform, you're going to get bored. They don't talk about that either. Yeah. Okay, in the footnote 27. In the purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 10.87.27, it is stated, Jaimini Rishi, in his Purva Mimamsa Sutras, right, Purva Mimamsa, Purva means the beginning of the Vedas, right, so that means there's Karma Mimamsa, and Uttara Mimamsa means the end of the Vedas, the Vedanta. Presents material work and its results as the whole of reality. Vipinam Ritam. He and later proponents of Karma Mimamsa philosophy teach that material existence is endless, that there is no liberation. For them, the cycle of karma is perpetual, and the best one can aim for is higher birth among the demigods. Therefore, they say, the whole purpose of the Vedas is to engage human beings in rituals for creating good karma, and consequently, the mature soul's prime responsibility is to ascertain the exact meaning of the Vedas' sacrificial injunctions and to execute them. Chodana lakshanor to dharma. Duty is that which is indicated by the injunctions of the Vedas. Purvimamsa Sutra 112. Right, so that seems to be, yeah, that would be the second verse of the Jaimini Sutras. The Vedanta Sutra, however, especially in the fourth chapter, which deals with life's ultimate goal, elaborately describes the soul's potential for achieving liberation from birth and death, while it subordinates ritual sacrifice to the role of helping one become qualified to receive spiritual knowledge. Right? In other words, the ritual sacrifice, you regulate your life, you have to have good qualities, you have to have sadhu sangha, you have to respect Brahmins, right, you have to be taking the remnants from sacrifice, all useful things. So if by having that lifestyle, then if you come in contact with bhakti, it'll be useful. So that's the only usefulness, is that if it does become used for bhakti, then it can be useful. But if it's not used for bhakti, it's still a waste of time. A real nice waste of time, but still a waste of time, right? As stated there, Vedanta Sutra 4.1.16, Agnihotradi tutat karyayaiva tat darshanat. The Agnihotra and other Vedic sacrifices are meant only for producing knowledge, as the statements of the Vedas show, right? Because from karma, you get jnana and vairag. So their only purpose is to get knowledge and get detached. And the very last words of the Vedanta Sutra, 4.4.22, proclaim, anavriti shabdat. The liberated soul never returns to this world, as promised by the revealed scripture. Right, so that kind of, thus the fallacious conclusions of the speculative philosophers prove that even great scholars and sages are often bewildered by the misuse of their own God, of their own God-given intelligence. As the Katha Upanishad 1.2.5 says, so they become, all these things are there, but they become bewildered as to how to actually apply them. That's the difficulty, because the attachment to seeing things separately from the Lord is very strong, so the tendency is to do that, and that has to be either through karma or jnana. Right? It means that's the alternatives for not seeing God, means you have to be doing it through karma or jnana, or any combination as you like, you know, like that. Okay. Here also, the liberated soul never returns to this world means it is, you can get out of it. It does end. So their point here is the material world never ends. We do say the material energy is eternal. Its manifestations are temporary. So they'll simply take that part, the material world is eternal, because they have to admit manifestations keep going, but it's always going to be there, so you can always do your karma. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the... Because even if they take it that, yes, okay, there's a destruction, then it starts again. Even if they took that, which they don't. Then the point is you're only going to come out because you're asleep during that time, so it's not a problem. When you come out, you just simply continue in the karma where you were. If you had good karma, you continue good. So it's not lost. Right? But they don't look at it that there is a beginning and an end. Right? Because to the material phenomena that is there, that the mahat is there, it's always there. But the manifestation, the Lord breathes out, it manifests, he breathes in, it's destroyed. So that part they don't seem to know, because they're not accepting God, so then they won't know about that. If they don't accept God, they don't know God breathes. And if you don't know God breathes, you don't know that there's creation and destruction. Right? You know, you only know how he's pervading and all that kind of thing. Okay, as the Katha Upanishad says, 1.2.5, caught in the grip of ignorance, self-proclaimed experts consider themselves learned authorities, right? Self-proclaimed experts. Nice. They wander about this world befooled, like the blind leading the blind. Self-proclaimed experts. Of the six orthodox philosophies of Vedic tradition, Shankhya, Yoga, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Mimamsa, and Vedanta, only the Vedanta of Bhadarayana Vyas is free of error. And even that only as properly explained by the bona fide Vaishnava Acharyas. Each of the six schools nonetheless makes some practical contribution to Vedic education. Atheistic Shankhya explains the evolution of natural elements from subtle to gross. Patanjali's Yoga describes the eightfold method of meditation. Nyaya sets forth the techniques of logic. Vaisheshika considers the basic metaphysical categories of reality. And Mimamsa establishes the standard tools of scriptural interpretation. Right? Means, in other words, not what is your interpretation, but what is the method of interpreting. And then whatever is your school, you would interpret that way. So that's why it's even though Mimamsa means all six, it's referred to as Mimamsa, which means how you interpret, because he's the school who gave exactly how to analyze how to analyze. Right? So that's what his contribution is. Apart from these six, there are also the more deviant philosophies of the Buddhists, Jains, and Charvakas. whose theories of voidism and materialism deny the spiritual integrity of the eternal soul. Right? So they don't even deal with the soul at all, these other ones. Right? You know, Charvaka is just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you're going to die, right? You know, so like that, that's his theory. So then it doesn't really, it's not very well developed. Right? But, you know, he's got it right about ghee, though. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's got that right. Ultimately, the only perfectly reliable source of knowledge is God himself. The personality of Godhead is Abodha Rasa, Avabodha Bodha Rasa, the infinite reservoir of unfailing vision. To those who depend on him with absolute conviction, he grants the divine eye of knowledge. Others, following their own respective theories, their own speculative theories, must grope for the truth through the obscure curtain of Maya. Right? And she keeps it obscure. Right? She only lets you see so much. Let's see. Okay. Heaven is regarded as the usual end of the rituals. Right? So this has been the earlier. Later, the Mimamsakas gradually fall in with the other Vedic schools and begin to accept liberation from bondage to the flesh as the highest good. They realize that performance of actions, good or bad, if dictated by any desire for enjoyment of objects, causes repeated birth and death. When one understands that worldly pleasures are all mixed with pain and becomes disgusted with life in the material world, one tries to control his passions, avoids forbidden actions, as well as actions motivated by desire for future enjoyment. Thus, the chance of future birth and bondage is removed. Right. So, in other words, means two aspects would be here. It's just natural that when they're younger, then they would go more for the karma aspect, and then when they get older, they go for the jnana aspect. You also have the thing is the early Mimamsakas, because it sounded great. But then after many generations, it wasn't so great, you know, as Prabhu's question came up. And so then they started looking at the liberation aspect of it. But still, the same theories, you know, it's still... So then their philosophy goes very nicely with that. Since you only want to enjoy, you don't want there to really be higher authority other than the Veda, which tells you the rituals how to enjoy, right? And at the same time, since you're just dealing with this universal consciousness, that works really nicely with liberation also. So that's what I was saying, is karma and jnana aren't actually that much different from each other. It's just, you know, the form of it looks different, but actually the principle, the mentality is the same. So it integrated quite easily into their system. So they'll know that ultimately, that's why they're worshipping the deity, getting the benefits, they know ultimately then there's void. So then they don't mind dealing with that. Does that make sense? So what we're seeing in Jayavadharma, those are later Mimamsakas. Mm. Right? They're not the earlier ones.
Okay. So they are more
advanced,
right? Dissolution?
On one level, yes, because the knowledge and the renunciation, and that is a higher principle. But on the principle of that, you know, the form of the Lord is Maya, there is no form, they're actually worse off. You know, like that. You know, it's kind of like, I guess it's kind of like saying, which is worse, being, you know, thrown off the top of the mountain or having them, you know, run threads through your body and then, you know, pull them, you know, like that, which is worse. You know, it's like, you know, they're all bad. You know. And that's the problem. Yes?
Yeah, liberation from bondage means voidism?
It just means it would be, because they're Vedic, it would be Brahman. Mm. Like that. It's the Buddhist and the Jains who would be void. Like that. You know, the Charvaks are just, you know, beg, borrow, or steal, but get ghee, right? You know, that's, the point is you know, the point is to enjoy life, and ghee is, you know, the actual enjoyment. So whatever you do, get ghee.
Getting, you know, by the prices of the ghee.
That's it. But I mean, olive oil is not any cheaper. Much, you know.
Here.
Huh?
Here. It's here.
Yeah, but then there's the problem is then which one's better, you know? Is it the Greek one, or is it the Italian, or is it the Spanish, or is it the Portuguese? Hmm? Yeah, then there's the... they're all arguing over it, you know.
Local.
yeah. So, but the thing is that the point is just, you know, eating is the only thing you can do all the time and always enjoy. Any other kind of enjoyment, you know, it's more temporary. But that's something you can always do, so...
Maharaj, I think there is an instance when Prabhupada, he wanted the devotees from Australia to pay for the books by ghee. He said the Australian ghee is very good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we used to, now you don't see it so much, but back in the late 70s, 80s, then there was tons of, ghee here meant Australian. But I think, I'm not sure, I mean, it depends who you ask, but some will say, whether the Australian is better or whether the New Zealand is better. As you know, so whether it's Allery or QBB, you know, that's the... I think that's where it comes down to, push comes to shove. But I'm not sure which was the... But you get them like this. They, so that's
I don't know how Australian temples would function without tea buckets.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything.
Yeah, yeah. Sir Pashad. You know, stick all your stuff in them, you know, everything like that. Right, everything. I mean, you take the ghee out after the ghee's out. it works out. But I remember during the 80s and all that, I was just cooking with Australian ghee. Like that. So it's... Yeah, it wasn't bad. Yeah. Just one funny story, but I got to tell Bhavananda first before I tell others. I said there's a story. I would have to tell it to Bhavananda first because he never knew the background of the events. So once we tell him, then we can tell others. Otherwise, he'd feel bad that he found out from others, you know. So.
In the shops over here, they sell two types of ghee. One is yellow, one is brown. They say one is for cooking, and the other is for eating.
No, it means you can cook with both. It means when it's made from butter, it's sweet. When it's made from yogurt, it's sour. So for cooking vegetables and things like that, the sour one adds some background, because you always want to put some sour into the vegetable. Like Westerners always put tomatoes, but in India you put tomato, use yogurt, they'll use this dried mango powder, or, you know, some different things to create it. So it works better for that. But for sweets, you want to use the one from butter. You don't want to use it for the other, you know. And depending upon what it is, what you're frying, if you're going to fry something and use it in the sabji, then the one from ghee is fine. I mean, one from yogurt is fine. But if it's just going to be fried and eaten straight, the one from the butter is fine. And sweets always make the one from butter. That's the difference. But generally when they put on the rice for eating with the vegetables, they'll use the brown one. But if it's too strong, then use the yellow one. Just depends. If you like that flavor, then... Thus, the chance for future birth and bondage is removed, right, by giving up fruit of action. By the disinterested performance of obligatory duties and knowledge of the self, the karmas accumulated in the past are also gradually worn out. Right? In other words, if you perform your duty without desire for the result, it's just naishkarmya, though you're not offering it to the Lord. It's renunciation. But you will get liberation from that, because if you continuously do that, there is no past karma. At some point, all the karma runs out. You don't produce any future karma here. Does that make sense? But it's not the kind of work that will get you into the spiritual world, right? it will get you out of the material world, but not into the spiritual world. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. You know, so your house is crazy. It gets you out of your house, but it doesn't get you into a nice house. It just leaves you on the street, right? You know, that's basically. So, therefore, for them, this nice karma, which we use, they'll use. But they're using it for a different purpose. So that's why you always have to watch. It's not that what people do is necessarily bad. It's their intention is bad. Right? So either we take it, oh, anything anybody does is bad because it's not, they're not a devotee. Or, oh, no, but this is okay. And then we get bewildered and take up their mood. The point is the activity done for Krishna is useful. Not done for Krishna is not useful. So if it's an authorized activity, the activity itself is useful for devotees because they'll use it for Krishna. But for the person who's using it, it's not useful because it's not for Krishna. So still it's going to be a problem for them. Is that sentence? After this life, such a person, freed of all karma, is never born again. As bondage is the fettering of the soul to the world through the body, liberation is total destruction of such bondage through the stoppage of rebirth. Right? So that much is correct. But the problem is that they'll be back again. Mm. Right? We have already seen that according to karma mimamsa consciousness and other mental states are not inherent in the soul. Okay, according to karma mimamsa, consciousness and other mental states are not inherent in the soul, but rather arise only when the soul is related to objects through the body and the senses. So again, they're saying consciousness comes from maya, from the material nature. So here the karmis say that, and the gyanis say that. So it's only the Vedanta is saying that the consciousness is inherent in the soul. Mm-hmm. Right. Therefore, the liberated soul, being disassociated from the body and thus free of all senses, cannot have any consciousness, nor it can therefore enjoy bliss. Liberated is then desirable not as an state of bliss, but as the total cessation of pain. Right? In other words, they're only worried about getting rid of the pain, because it's not actually bliss. It is a state where the soul resides in its own intrinsic nature, beyond pleasure and pain. Some later mimamsakas hold, however, like the Advaitins, that liberation is the experience of joy. Right? Because otherwise, if you say that, it's just getting rid of the pain. But then after a while, people go, hey, wait a minute, but we want to be happy. Right? So you can see as they keep having to adjust and change according to the perception of the people. Right? You know, just go to heaven, that's great, but I'm still not enjoying. So therefore liberation, but then, you know, that's, you're not offering any joy, it's just getting rid of the pain. Oh yes, so you'll be happy in liberation, right? So they have to keep adjusting.
So this is where the principle of Brahmananda comes in?
Yes, so that's where Brahmananda comes in.
It's a last kind of station.
Yes, but the problem is that if you have no consciousness like this, like all these schools are saying, except for Vedanta, then how will you enjoy it anyway? So that's there. So then in Vedanta they're talking about Brahmananda, but if you're one with Brahman, how do you enjoy Brahman? You know,
maybe just being together.
But then you're not together, you're just one. There is no together. It's just you know what I'm saying? You're just existing in a state of that. But what do you compare it to? So why would you call it bliss? Right? You're outside and it's really hot. You come inside, it's cool. You call that bliss. Or you're outside, it's cold. You come inside, it's warm. You call that bliss. But as soon as you adjust, then bliss is then checking out what's in the refrigerator. Right? Because now there is no bliss. It means you're either, you've cooled down or you've warmed up. So there's no bliss. So as soon as it becomes equal and the same, as soon as you merge with the room and whatever the temperature is, your temperature and the room temperature are the same, there's no enjoyment. It's not uncomfortable. You know, it's not uncomfortable, but it's not, you know, comfortable. It's just existing. So that's what Brahman is. They don't think about it. They just think how it'll be great being there. But it'll be great being there means there's two. So I can appreciate the Brahmananda. But once you're there, there is no real Ananda. Compared to here, yes. But compared to the spiritual, no. It's just a state of spiritual existence. So it's okay. It's, you know, it's tatasta. So it works, but it doesn't. You can't stay there because the jiva, being so small, has to be under the internal or external. So being in the Brahma Jyoti, you can't be there for long, because where is the energy? Right? It's just the Lord. So the point is therefore you have to interact with the energy. And then you're going to, and the energy is the Swarup Shakti. And the Swarup Shakti is, you see it in relationship with the Lord, it's internal. You don't see it in relation with the Lord, it's external. So since they haven't accepted the personality of Godhead, then it has to be external. So again, they come back into the material nature. Just by definition, they have to.
Isn't jiva itself an energy?
Yes, but it's so small, it's dependent. Means the other energies are dependent upon the Lord, but we're dependent upon the energies that are dependent upon the Lord, because we're so small, like that. So that's why we're always servant of the servant. We're not defined. Well, I mean, in generic, we'll say one is servant of the Lord, but in technical, we're servant of the servant. So the servant means the internal potency. Or we're servant of Maya. I mean, if one wants to go with that. We think we're the Lord of Maya. No, we're servant of Maya. Right? So it's just like the. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so we'll end here. And tomorrow we'll read this footnote, and then we'll go on to Vedanta. How big is Vedanta? Okay, not so big. Sorry?
Tomorrow's Saturday.
Oh, tomorrow's Saturday. So Monday.
Monday. The 1st of January.
1st of January.
New year.
The new year. So next year we'll read this. Huh? 31st. Oh, okay. So at the end of the year. Then on Tuesday. Yeah, I did that on my calendar also. Because the calendars, they put Monday as first. Well, always before it was Sunday was first. Or something else, you know, like that. But I don't know. I got confused also.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.